Coming up, director, writer, and producer Dave Merkin joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. I am Ileana Douglas.
Yes, you are.
I'm here with Tamara Berg, my lovely producer, co-host.
Hello, everybody.
It is so great to be here. We have a really big show. I'm very excited to talk to Dave Merkin, amazing writer, producer, director. I'm going to save it all for the interview.
But I had to cut you guys off. We were in here just chatting a few minutes ago, and I said, stop.
She's one of the funniest people ever.
I can't.
He's one of the people that, like, if I go to a party and he's there, I go right to him. Oh, sorry, I had a little hair.
I'm primping
thank
you.
Thank you.
Don't mind me.
You're like Roman Polanski on the set of Chinatown.
The number of times I've heard that.
That's what he did.
That's what he did to
Faye Dunaway. It made her have a nervous breakdown. Was the big thing in Chinatown. He was. She was doing the bedroom scene with Nicholson, Jack Nicholson.
Jack Nicholson.
And they're in bed, and he leaned in and apparently plucked a hair. He literally yanked it, I guess, and she lost it. She freaked out.
Wow.
Didn't speak to each other for the rest of the rest of the movie. So anyway,
yeah.
Tip. There's a tip. Don't pluck a woman's hair out when you're shooting with her. Let's. What's going on?
Okay, so I was thinking about how there are so many platforms for entertainment these days.
God!
There's Hulu and Netflix,
and that's
and
just
Amazon
in my bedroom,
TV, right?
Yeah,
exactly. Actual films. So with that, you know, it used to be that there was a real kind of hard and fast rule about how comedy had to end. And one of the things that I was reading Dave says is, you know, a lot of his comedy wasn't well received early on because everything had to end with a hug.
Yes.
Right? And so now it seems to me, and I want your opinion on this, is there more freedom in how things can be expressed because the platforms are so varied now?
It's going to be really interesting to talk to Dave. I have interviewed Carl Reiner about comedy. He complains that the problem with comedy currently is that the show is too short. So literally there's not enough time to set up a proper comic situation in which to have a payoff. So he said, therefore, that's why there's so much toilet humor, because everybody can kind of understand that.
Right.
So I that really resonates with me, because, you know, I like the long, you know, your show of shows, the Mary Tyler Moore show. I am schooled, and I also write in the very traditional, longer type comedy with a comic situation. What I find is the messy distortion between, is this supposed to be funny or is it a drama? And there's no real distinction, meaning there's a lot of kitchen sink things, except on, you know, the only people doing old school comedy, and I don't want to say only, but that seems to be prevalent is on CBS. Like, that's where you want to see the old school comedy, and it ends with a hug. I think that's what, you know, that's the traditional thing. So it's interesting that can live with some, you know, with Veep. But
right.
I think that all of us are all over the map.
Right.
As to what is funny. Some people love Modern Family. Some people hate it. You know,
I'm a lover of Modern Family.
Yeah, I love it. I don't like the way it's shot. But again, that's just my personal.
Uh-huh.
I don't like a moving camera when it comes to comedy.
Uh-huh.
So in that sense, I am a traditionalist. I like Peter Bogdanovich. Wide. I want to just enjoy the people. And so what Modern Family does is they swing to the joke.
Right.
So, does that make sense?
Yes.
Like the camera's moving all over you know, we swing for a reaction, or we cut to the interview for the kind of the reaction. For me personally, I find that lets the air out of some of the joke, but that's just my personal, you know, that's my personal preference. I love Veep. I've talked about this again and again. That for me is the funniest show that's so on, good. And it does not do a lot of it. It's very traditional the way it's shot, and that's why I love it. I want to see everybody in the frame. I want to see everybody reacting with everybody else, and that is my favorite because I know I'm in good hands. For me, when the camera's moving all over the place, it makes me uneasy.
Right. But the thing about Veep is it is traditional in the sense of what you were just saying, but the jokes are, you know, they let things sit, and they do this sometimes in Modern Family as well. Mm-hmm. You know, they really let things sit. Sometimes you get them, sometimes you don't. You know, there was something funny there. Oh, well, moving on. Because I actually rewind Modern Family mm-hmm. all the time because it comes so fast. And not that I didn't get it. I like to enjoy the joke a second time on that show, especially.
Yes.
And New Girl is another one that that strikes me that way. Which I just find hilarious. But so, do you think it's a good thing that there's a lot of variants, or are you strictly a traditionalist?
I mean, I'd say this is, you know, like I'm of the old school. My the other night I'm watching Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau on the Johnny Carson show, circa 1981. That's my level.
That's your jam.
That's what
is
I'm doing. I guess there's a show called The Voice on, but I ain't seeing it. To me, Your Show of Shows was the greatest show about comedy ever, written, you know, by Neil Simon, who I think is the greatest comedy writer of all time.
Absolutely.
The movie The Odd Couple to me is, you know, it's a 10. That for me is comedy gold. Nothing gets better than Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau in The Odd Couple. Mm-hmm. For me personally, mm-hmm. and Sid Caesar, you know, in my favorite sketch of all time, it's called Aggravation Boulevard. Maybe try to find it on.
Oh.
It's a parody of Sunset Boulevard. You have to know the movie, which is based on Sunset Boulevard. And then my second favorite is the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Yeah.
That never ended in a hug. You know, but I think that the characters, the relationship of the family that they all had, and the writing on that set, you know, and the was just incredible. And then currently, I mean, we're going to be talking to Dave, but what I find so fascinating, and we'll ask him about this too, is he said that you can get away with things in animation that you can't get away with regular people, and the executives, audiences won't accept it, but you can accept it in a comic. But I think it's incredible that The Simpsons has been on all these years, surpassing
everything,
any other television show
ever
of all time.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You know, it's amazing that it still resonates, and it's, you know, it probably has to do again with the writers and the family of writers, and those are going to be all interesting questions I'm going to ask him. But in terms of, do we all laugh at the same things? That's tough.
Well, see, that's sort of why I love that there are many platforms and many opportunities for things, because there are things like, you know, like I was saying, Modern Family and New Girl, which are more traditional, and then there are things like Catastrophe. Right? On Netflix? Is it on Netflix or Amazon?
Is this the Billy Bob Thornton?
No.
Oh, okay. Mm-mm. See, there's too many.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Well, that's the thing. You know, it used to be you could go, there are five shows on, I've seen them all. And so many that, I mean, that's why binge watching has become a thing, because you have to at some point sit down and watch everything all at once. But the humor and Catastrophe is really incredibly dark. And and also things like Orange is the New Black. Considered a comedy by some, not by a lot of some of us don't think it's a comedy, but you know, there are so many different choices out there, and I like the idea that that comedy, the sitcom, television can be opened up and maybe tweaked a little bit, and you know, you can try different things. So that's why I like that there are, you know, so many different ways you can go with it, because again, speaking about networks and network executives, there's maybe a little more leeway, a little more opportunity, and a little more possibility for something different.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, again, just literally I was listening as you were talking. No, and I was thinking of, again, film versus TV and film comedy, very sharp.
Yes.
You know, and versus television, currently television, which is... as I said before, kitchen sink, not really sure, is this funny, is it not mm-hmm. funny, and again yeah. I like it to be very well defined. Comic situation, you mm. know, The Graduate,
right?
Guy's gotta go rent a room to have an affair, and you got everything is gold, you know, so there's the setup,
right?
So we're in good hands. So yes. he goes to the front desk and there's Buck Henry, and you know, anything that ensues, you're already primed and prepped to laugh.
Yeah.
And a lot of the times on television, you know, you don't know where the laugh is. Mm. Or then you have the opposite thing, where there's certain comics who are on television shows, and they put the big laugh track behind them, and they're not saying anything funny except for like boobs. Like there are certain shows.
Well,
do you notice that?
Yes,
it's like big boobs. Wah! You know, and so is it a show for a four-year-old? Because I do. I'll switch through. I mean, tear me away during the commercials of the old Johnny Carson show or Get TV or TCM. I'll switch around just to see what's going on. And it's not like I'm I feel like I'm particularly missing anything.
Right. Right.
You know.
Well, I think we should bring in Dave.
Yes, I can't wait. Let's. I mean, my goodness, what hasn't he done? He's directed. My God, the film, of course, Heartbreakers, Romeo and Michelle's High School Reunion, I mean, The Simpsons. What else can we say about this? You've done so much. We don't have enough time. Why haven't you written a book? Ladies and gentlemen, Dave Merkin.
Yay. Hi, everybody.
Thank you for coming here.
Oh, it's so good to be here. Your show's terrific. Like we were talking about, it has great depth, which you just don't have enough of anymore. And
thank you.
So somebody that really knows what they're talking about and is not drunk off their ass.
Well,
just, it's great.
Today.
Well, it's early.
Just today.
It's still early.
It
yeah,
is early.
It is.
Just today. So there's so much I want to ask you. So I hate to get like, we're not going to do the chit chat, but what is the first movie you saw and who took you to see it?
I had no idea I was going to be asked this. this is the main thing they tell you about this show 12
yes.
times. And it involved an enormous amount of research on my part because it's a complicated answer.
Yeah, see, that's why we ask again and again.
That's why, because we had television in the house from the time my consciousness was beginning.
Yes.
So I was being hit with all kinds of things before I, you know, was processing them, and even being brought to the movies before I was fully processing them as major conscious events.
Yes.
So I realized that one of the earliest things that was getting into my consciousness, because it's what I would watch in the midst of Bugs Bunny cartoons, which are very, very intelligent. They're really written for adults. And that influenced me. On that same show, an enormous amount of Three Stooges, which influenced my real life in an enormous way. I still hit people with a wrench when I'm angry. It's just, you know, it's a way to deal with problems.
Poke their eyes.
It was. So, and those films are brilliantly made, by the way. The Three Stooges don't get enough credit. It's so complicated. They shot them so quickly. The sound effects are amazing. The coordination is amazing. Special effects of destroying a house are amazing.
Right.
And they were perfect pre-things to the Marx Brothers that I saw later and everything.
Right.
And then also the god of that time, I was being brought to kiddie matinees and seeing Jerry Lewis movies. So I was saying, I know you love him. And I do too. And we put him on The Simpsons, you know, because we ripped him off on The Simpsons, you know.
Yeah.
Professor Frank is Jerry Lewis. And so he came and he was suing us, and the settlement was to have him on the show. I might be making that up, but you'll never know.
No,
I lie a lot. But anyway, he's brilliant. He's a genius. And as a little kid, 6 years old, he's a god. You know, you're watching Cinderfella. You're watching, the bellhop, bellboy, ladies' man. And then, you know, which came a little bit later, the thing you could never believe in, a huge influence, was The Nutty Professor, because
yeah.
you saw the idiot become cool. And, you know, always, I was a very smart kid, so I always knew I was an idiot as a kid and a moron. So
yeah.
the fact that I was Jerry Lewis and then he could be cool gave me hope. It gave me hope to survive. So all that was percolating around.
Mm-hmm.
We had this amazing theater open in our neighborhood, between 1,000 and 2,000 seats, just like the interior of the National, but in Philadelphia,
yeah.
New Orleans. the most amazing room I ever saw when I walked in this brand new theater. Orange seats in the biggest room I'd ever seen. Wow. It almost hurt my eyes because I was very sensitive to color and sound and taste when I was very young. And so this theater was amazing. And in that theater, my mother brought me to see Dr. No, because I liked adult stuff too. So right. that blew me away. But the movie that made the biggest impression, oh, and the other thing that was percolating around that I saw several years, they started to play The Wizard of Oz
right.
on CBS.
Yes.
And so that was amazing, but it was still on a small screen. Mm-hmm. The movie that first blew my mind was Babes in Toyland, which is the Disney film. It brought me to the Orleans to see the Disney film,
yes.
Babes in Toyland. And you had, I love flexible reality, and that had flexible reality, and it had the toy soldiers
yes.
stop motion animation mixed with live action, everything a kid wants to see, and great songs. And I had the album, so I was able to completely immerse myself. Pretty strong stuff. But the ultimate.
See, this is like a movie
not a
soup.
Answer.
I know. I apologize for
no, this is great.
This is an infuriating long answer is what I would say.
I could go. This is, for me, this is like drugs.
I know. It's more like porn, to be honest. Okay. So anyway, and you'll like this answer. My father died when I was 5 years old. Hilarious, right?
Yes.
No, actually, it was the worst and best thing that happened simultaneously. I wouldn't be here now if he didn't die, because that created the situation that really formed me into an artist and want to work toward that and want to heal that.
Right.
So you call that, I coined this phrase, people have to pay whenever they use it. It's a blurse. It's a blessing and a curse.
Oh, I love it.
Isn't that great? Isn't that great? That's copyright me. I'm pretty sure I own it. You okay. both owe me $5 just for me saying
it. Putting the copyright symbol on it's, my
page. It's great. That. So that's what that was. So the yes. family was depressed. Sears, I had a brother that was 13 years older than me. My mother saw it fall apart and that whole kind of thing. And we had to go downtown to see the Cinerama movie. It's a mad, 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 mad world.
Yay.
Yes. You couldn't go to the Orleans because they didn't have the Cinerama thing. So we did huge. We never went downtown. But we had to go all the way downtown. It's a half an hour trip. It's hard to park, all that stuff. Went to the Boyd Theater, saw my first Cinerama movie, which, you know, is this giant, giant 2.85 aspect ratio. The biggest thing you ever saw. The clearest thing you ever saw. Amazing car chases. And all the things I was watching on television, every comedian I ever saw together in the one movie, brilliantly, right?
Yes.
And it's fantastically funny and brilliant. And then you're watching it. Jack Benny shows up, right? And then Jerry Lewis shows up. I mean, the God is in it. And so you're watching. It's a 3.5 hour movie. But even as a kid, I didn't want it to end. And then toward the very end of the movie, the Three Stooges are in it. So it's this complete giant circle orgasmic thing. And when the family came out of that, they were cured. It didn't matter my father had died at that, but no, it actually did. But it brought them back. Yeah. The comedy saved them.
Yes.
And I'll say very quickly, what's hilarious about your story and your book is that Dennis Hopper fucked up your life.
Right?
But then you were saved by movies again. So they messed you up and then they saved you. So I like, because usually the stories are all about being saved. But anyway, all right, sorry. Okay.
God, that's amazing. See, to me, well, your story of It's a Madman World, you know, that's how I feel about movies. But, and that's why we do the show, because I feel like there was a time where movies saved your life.
Yes. Yes.
You invested in them. They were your friends. That it was the only relatable thing. I mean, I know in my family, it's like you would be really mad at each other, but that would be the one thing is like, you want to go to the movie? Yeah, all right.
Sit in the dark next to you. I don't have to talk.
And then, like, you know, eventually it would be like, did you like it? You know, we'd talk about the movie. That was always the thing that would, you know, that would bring our family together.
No, it's true. And then, you know, in terms of TV, hearing that intelligence coming out of the TV and the emotion and the empathy that was on the shows in that time, because, you know, Dick Van Dyke show started when I was 5 and 6 years old. It was the smartest thing I ever heard coming out of the television. I became fascinated with that because I was surrounded, not my family, but in terms of I was surrounded by morons. And yet there were all these smart people in the box and coming from somewhere. And that really was, it gave me hope. It gave me, you know, great excitement. And it really led, I mean, I've done a lot of things, but the reason I'm on The Simpsons is because of the Dick Van Dyke Show. It all kind of
because they're
up.
Comedy writers, and you they said were that comedy could be a, writers. That could be a profession.
That made me want to be a comedy writer. Other things made me want to be a director. The Graduate made me want to be a director. That was really the first time that I really that popped into my head. But I wanted to be a writer before that because of Dick Van Dyke Show. And Dick Van Dyke Show created Mary Tyler Moore. Mary Tyler Moore created MTM, which created Jim Brooks. And he was a huge mentor that I was learning from as a child or a kid.
Yeah.
And I wanted to work with him. And that's the whole reason I wound up going on The Simpsons. I mean, I had worked with him just as a guest on the Tracy Ullman show.
Right.
Because I was fortunate that he liked my work and wanted to work with me. And I was desperate to work with him. And then one of the main reasons was to go on The Simpsons was to experience the Jim Brooks experience.
But you started out, your first sort of professional jobs working as a stand-up.
Was a stand-up. The first way I made money when I was trying to break in as a writer, you could make money as a stand-up much quicker and much faster. So you go to the Comedy Store and I was very lucky. The first time I performed at the Improv, had it not gone well, I never would have done it again, but it went great. The audience was very kind, and then I quickly became a regular at the Comedy Store. And then when they would see you at the Comedy Store, they would book you around the country.
Wow.
And you would wind up in a comedy condo with Bobcat Goldthwait, which is its own kind of nightmare.
Now, when he's on in a couple of weeks, we'll ask him about this.
He won't remember me, or that actually part of the settlement is he's not allowed to talk about our relationship.
You had a famous opening line. What was your...
My opening line, I was always from a dark point of view in my shows. So I would walk on stage and I would say, is it just me or has everybody been coughing up blood lately? And the greatest moment of that would be if the audience did not laugh. Because, and this is why I was more of a writer than a performer. If I would do a joke and I do it 50, 100 times and it would do great, when it wouldn't do well, that was funny to me because I knew the joke was all right and I knew if I said it right, it wasn't. Sometimes you get a bad audience. Sometimes, not even a bad audience, but a quiet audience. Because I did all these shows in front of a live audience. I did Three's Company and I ran the Newhart Show. And you would learn sometimes that audiences were quiet, even if the show was great. And sometimes they were hugely laughing, even if the show was, So you got over the fact of an audience reaction. The Graduate would die in certain screenings early on. Mm-hmm. And nothing has changed in that performance. Wow. So that just shows you how the audience matters. The makeup of it, the moment of it. Mm-hmm. I won't do a preview screening unless the temperature is below 68 degrees. Because if it's too hot, no one's going to laugh. Yeah. Well, and I canceled the screening because of that.
I know, but people always, Letterman was 50.
Yeah, the same thing. That's exactly, he knows exactly what he's doing.
Yep.
He's good. I predict David Letterman will be successful.
You think?
Yeah, I think that will happen.
Wow.
Susie loses the beard. But so you're doing stand-up, but let me get this straight. So you were doing stand-up, but your real goal was to be a writer.
Be a writer and, way in the back of my mind to be a director, because I had been making movies from the time I was a kid. I'm an electronics engineer. That's what I had. In my family, you got to do something that made sense and all that. So that's what my father was. He was a computer scientist and electronics engineer and, kind of killed him young. So that was sort of a lesson, But I was still following in those footsteps. I couldn't wait to die young. And I never thought that you could make a living doing this because we had that kind of family. That's kind of a dream thing. And, and people would tell me I was funny, but I was in Philadelphia and I figure I'm funny in Philadelphia. I'm watching the Dick Van Dyke Show, and it was such genius.
Yes.
I think I'm not going to be able to compete with that. But I didn't realize that that involved just hours and hours of honing and working, and that's how it gets to that point, that it's not instantly like that. That was this great thing. And it really helped me later as a director because you have enormous empathy for actors. I love actors so much, And being on a stand-up, you know how to talk to them because you know what they're up against. You know the vulnerability. You know what they're feeling.
No, but Dave, not everybody is like that. I mean, like I was saying before, I said if Dave is at a party, I go, oh, my God, thank you. At least he'll talk to me.
And I'm here. That's it. Not that I'm funny or interesting. No. I'm just the only one who will talk.
But like, no, and it's going to be funny. You're going to have observations. it's a good time.
It is a good time.
For me.
That's the greatest thing about show business is to meet other, really smart, talented people. It's the greatest blessing of the whole thing.
But when I work with Gary Shandling, I go, Gary, or I come up and say really funny, and he just stare at me. No. He wouldn't even go, that's not funny. He'd just go, yeah.
Gary would struggle with, you know, happiness and being open. And, you know, sometimes he was, sometimes he isn't. You know, Steve Martin is like that. You know, everybody knows.
Oh, the worst day of my life was the
Hear
day.
Hear that, Steve? The worst day.
The worst day of my life was the party that I was invited to at Eric Idle's house with the comedy. Gary, there's Steve Martin. It was like, it was the most uncomfortable. It was so tense. And again, once again, I think you were the only person that was sort of
I was the only person there that was fun. No, those parties can be, but yeah, there have been times
intimidating.
They can be very intimidating. I've had times when I've been very intimidated by Steve because he can be very quiet. He's really very, very shy. And then there are times when he's just like Steve and he's entertaining you one on one. I figured I had a breakthrough with Steve. He loves me. We're good friends. And the next time I see him, Steve, how you doing? He's like, you know, so it's like rolling the dice, you know. But, you know, I still love him. And, you know, everybody. You know, the thing is, I used to be able to say this. You can't really say it anymore because we're now on the internet and there's so many different ways. If you can tune them in, they're out of their minds, right? That's why we're here. We all have, you know, issues one way or the other. Me, I can only get release by strangling kittens. But I'm still a nice person to humans, you know. And these are rescue kittens. They're not, you know, I don't just buy like, yeah. So I hope that doesn't upset anyone.
No, not at all. No. On that happy note. So now you're working, so I want to get into writing.
I'm writing spec scripts while I was doing that. You know, while I was doing stand up, TV spec scripts.
What are some of the themes of these specs?
Strangling kittens for release.
Number one.
Not popular. Not good responses. Very poor testing.
Do you have an agent? Like, are you?
I got an agent who is actually an agent for a writer. Actually, had written a Dick Van Dyke show, who then became an agent. So it's like, this is a dream.
Oh my God!
Somebody who wrote an episode of the Dick Van Dyke show can be a sucky agent. By the way, you know, writers are not the best agents. He was a very nice guy, but he was not gonna. What eventually happened is I knew no one in show business. I had a cousin who knew someone who worked in the accounting department at 20th Century Fox who knew a living, breathing comedy writer named George Tricker. Super nice guy. Worked on Welcome Back, Cotter was one of the big things. And I sent George my stuff, and he was very, very encouraging, super nice, and really helped me out. And he said, you know what you need to do? You need to write, because he got on the Ropers.
Uh-huh. The
Ropers. Norman Fell and the connection to The Graduate. So Norman Fell, brilliant. I was, you know, all the actors on Three's Company were actually lovely and nice. But anyway, so I had no interest in Three's Company or The Ropers. It was not my. I wanted to be on Taxi. That was the kind of thing that I was just totally crazy for. MTM type comedy and all that. And but you know, to get a start, I wrote this spec Ropers, and George, which is a huge mistake to write a spec for the show that you're trying to get on. Mm-hmm. George didn't really know this, even though he was on the show. And he gave it to the guy running the Ropers, did not like it. So, okay, that's it. But then my Ropers got into the hands of Bernie West, who was one of the great writers of All in the Family, along with Mickey Ross, all the great, amazing shows. But the show they really wanted to do was Three's Company. The first pilot of Three's Company was written by Larry Gelbart. And it was brilliant, character-driven comedy, still starring John Ritter. But it was real smart, real intelligent. Didn't go. Then ABC got Mickey and Bernie and Don Nickel from England, you know, the three guys from All in the Family, and they turned it into a sex farce comedy.
Right.
Which America reacted to. It was about not having sex. If you notice, nobody ever gets sex on Three's Company. That America reacted to that, being frustrated sexually. Mm-hmm. Became this huge hit, the biggest thing in the world. He liked my thing. I got into pitch. Took me actually a while to finally get a script.
Right.
I got my first script, and I wrote it. I handed it in. I went to Sequoia National Forest camping, and I got a call that I was on staff with Three's Company. I didn't want to be on staff on Three's Company. I don't want to. This is a huge, long story. But I didn't really have a choice. I needed to make some money. And my agent told me they were interested in me on Cheers. Now, Cheers was the lowest rated show on TV, only next to Hill Street Blues at that point. They were waiting to see if they got a back nine. They said if they got a back nine, they would give me one of those scripts. That would have been my dream. my agent, or really the manager, who also packaged Three's Company, said, we'll put you on Three's Company, and then if the Cheers thing comes through, you can move over to Cheers. I believed him. I went on the Three's Company. It was a lovely experience. Taught me a lot. Taught me nobody can say anything smart on Three's Company. All the humor is in the French farce structure. Right. So I learned structure like almost no one else. Wow. Everybody tried to write for that show, and they couldn't. But if you really studied structure, you could. So they thought it was really easy. It wasn't. There were very few people in town. So it was like this great job that taught me structure. And then I didn't hear from Cheers. I'm a very shy guy, believe it or not. I really am. And I don't bother people. I don't. So I eventually called. Like, I said, why don't I hear anything? And the Cheers people told me, oh, well, your agent nixed that for you. Yeah, because, you know, he packaged Three's Company. And Three's Company was the number one or number two show. And Cheers, and they couldn't see the difference. I said, can't you see the difference? And they said, no, one is successful and one isn't. This is good, and we package it and whatever.
Yes.
So I stayed there for about a year or two, whatever. I think I wrote 7-10 scripts or something. And then I turned it down, the pickup, to keep going. And I was very brave in my mind, but when I was doing it on the phone, my hand was shaking like this. Because I was turning down like a quarter of a million or something.
And how
at
do
that
you
point.
Turn it down? Just give
I
me
I just
a...
said, I love you guys, you know, but I need to go and try and do something. And this was the time the comedy was dead. They said comedy was dead. Of course, people stopped wanting to laugh. That's just a fact of life. And this was before Cosby. This is when he was not, he didn't have the big show. All he was doing was molesting women when he wasn't on TV. This was a different period of time.
So the Benadryl.
Yeah, it was. He was busy. He was very busy with the drugs. He was working out the right formula for his drink. Yeah,
gosh.
This is all before. This, by the way, this you're liable for what I'm saying, not me.
What? So, my note here. Your comedy seems to veer towards the surreal and the dark.
Surreal and the dark.
Okay.
It's true because that I think that my death of my father really, really hit that. And the great thing that I love about show business, and you're a perfect example of that, is horrible things can happen to you in the movie, but I knew very early on that the people making the movie were actually laughing in between the takes. So that you could actually have these horrible things happening, but it was really just people playing, just like I was playing with my friends. And you wanted to surround yourself in that life where you really were controlling the outcome of everything and having a great time doing it instead of interacting in real life. And that's what we do so poorly, is interact in real life poorly, and we get to control our phony lives.
Well, it's so are you saying, which is what I've always said about show business, is that yes, there was the aspect, yes, I want to be a great actor, but I also would look at the books and, oh, they're having so much fun. Like,
that's
I wanted to sit in the director's chair. Because that's what I saw my grandfather doing instead of being there. And he's sitting next to Jack Warden and Peter Sellers. And that part was just as good to me. I was like, I got to somehow tell good stories, funny stories, so I can sit in one of those chairs with them.
And it's that win-win where you're trying to teach other people, trying to do for other people the way comedy or television and movies saved you. You're trying to save them. You're trying to teach them that there's a way to navigate. Art teaches people how to navigate through life. Good art does that. Mm-hmm. It saves you. It protects you. And you want to give that back, what you got.
Right.
But it's also, when it goes well, it's the greatest, most fun thing in the world. And it's really the only place that weird people like us ever feel at home, start to feel relatively normal.
Right.
Because real life is what feels like the craziest, most moronic thing in the world. Mm-hmm. And the more I can get people to understand that real life should not be taken seriously, and that the thing, you're talking about sitcoms before. The thing I hate about sitcoms that end with a hug is that's a horrible lie. Because it makes everybody watching a 22-minute show think that they're complete losers if they can't solve all their problems in 22 minutes.
Hallelujah. Yes.
There's nothing wrong with shows that do that. But when it becomes all the shows that do that, which is the general goal of a network-driven, consumer-driven, product-driven thing, is to make people feel good, is to drug them. That's bad because everybody feels like an idiot. Why can't I make my life like, these people, happy people on TV? So and The Simpsons always did that. And all my shows, everything gets fucked up. Everything gets horribly messed up. But that's okay. You can survive that. It's still funny. It's still okay. That's what really represents getting through life in a positive way. as opposed to the bullshit, happy horseshit that we just hug it out at the end of the day.
Why is that so? I mean, when I was growing up, I watched the I was very influenced by the Marx Brothers, and then graduated kind of to, you know, Mel Brooks, Woody Allen. Then I discovered your Show of Shows, and as I said, like
backwards.
Yeah, because they put out the movie 10 from your Show of Shows.
That's right. That's great.
In the 70s. And once, when I discovered Sid Caesar, that for me was, you know, not that I would ever be Sid Caesar, just any, but that to me was.
You strike me much more as Richard Dreyfuss than Sid Caesar.
Yes, that was my drug. But that's my favorite word in comedy is pathos.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it's both. You know, you touched on that too. The best writing has everything in it. Mm-hmm. It has comedy and darkness together. You know, these dramas that have no humor, to me, are incompetent, because that's not a representation of life. Mm-hmm. A representation of life, and if you want to really, really punch someone in the gut with drama, have humor. Have someone laughing, and then bring something into it.
Yes.
You know, Terms of Endearment or something is something that comes to mind that kind of mixes the two brilliantly. That's the way you do it. Whenever there's anything that's just one thing in a drama, just, oh, well, let's see how dark we can get. Let's see how dingy we can be. Mm-hmm. That's, anyone can do that. I don't find that to be skillful.
I totally agree. And we were talking to the actress Shirley Knight about Chekhov, and I'm
from Star Trek. Yeah, that's a great character. Oh, man. Yeah, he's one of my favorites. And Shirley never shuts up about
him. I was meaning the Russian player.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he's good too.
He balances good comedy and
he does, you know, and it's funny because people go, I don't want to read all that.
I know.
I say, read it. It's brilliantly funny. Completely understands how hilarious tragedy is. I mean, it's very funny in addition to, and when you're able to see the terrible things that happen and find the humor in it, there's the power. Mm. There's the way you get saved.
There's a lot of humor in the book Lolita.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I remember when the movie is very, you know, funny. Well, you're a big Kubrick
oh, yeah.
fan.
Yeah.
But the book, I was like, there's a lot of humor in this.
No, like all the best stuff has got to have both, or it's bullshit.
Yes.
You know, it's not really, you know, what life is, unless you're living a very kind of like low IQ one note existence, but I don't really see people doing that.
I want to talk, of course, about the movies that you directed, but I have to get you to tell your story about being there, about how you, because that's our interesting connection.
We have some interesting connections.
I know.
It's not even just, I was always going to just mention to you,
sure,
because you kind of got started with The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yes.
Which, do you know how The Last Temptation of Christ got started?
I sort of do, but the book was Barbara Hershey.
That's right, Barbara Hershey during Boxcar Bertha.
Yes.
Marty's best film, maybe? And no, it's a great, everything he does
not
is fantastic.
Not Kundun?
I remember I saw that with Barbara.
You did?
Yeah, because Barbara became a friend because I directed a James Taylor video, and she was the star of it. We'll have to get to James Taylor.
Tulane Blacktop.
Tulane Blacktop, which is a great, crazy movie. But yeah. But Barbara gave him the book. So she started that. And then because she couldn't scream, that began, right?
Wow.
Well, no, in fairness to Barbara, it was because it was like old school movies. They used styrofoam rocks to throw.
So you couldn't use her screams.
Right.
Oh,
I see.
It's okay.
Like the
sorry if I said anything negative about Barbara screaming.
They had used, Italian extras. And so the whole movie sounded talk about comedy. To see that, and I didn't know anything about movies, but to see that film, like, what is Martin Scorsese? He directed this film, you know, with the bad extras.
This was a great question for you to turn the tables.
Yes.
The interviewer becomes the interviewer.
Do it.
Yes.
Yeah.
How do you say that name? Because, and this is also, this
Scorsese.
Connects up to one of the Scorsese.
Scorsese.
I would swear in your book you say Scorsese at times, but I may be wrong. And this is a side note. You guys, you know, you push your book, you say it. It's a fantastic book. But I have to say, the mistake you make is you say, oh, it's paperback, it's in hardcover.
Yes.
You got to get the Audible book because she's hilarious.
Oh, thank
you. That's, you know, whenever there's a memoir done by somebody who's also a great performer, get the memoir to listen to it. And, you know, someone that knows comedy, it is so funny in so many places to hear, and your excitement, and it's just hilarious. And the fact that you love, you know, she calls it, it's always interesting to me, it's like about what somebody thinks of something. You mostly call them movies. And movies are, have all this kind of childhood love. And then yes. if you're more sophisticated, you say film. And Marty says picture. You know, you go way back in time, your love of, I'm always fascinated by that. But just to say, I'm in a movie. I mean, it's just, it's great. It's great. So you have to get the Audible version of this. It's so much fun to listen to it. It's so entertaining. You can't stop listening to it. It's really, you have a great, hilarious voice at times, too.
Thank you.
It's good.
I know. Well, which is my start in show business.
And, you did stand up and all that, too.
I did stand up with my, you know, but, and then when I was in acting school, my teacher, they tried to get me to change my voice. We had a teacher, they taught Edith Skinner.
Oh, right, right.
Who came out of Carnegie Mellon, and, you know, and that, and so basically I had like a weird, I had the Madonna. Like Audrey Hepburn kind of, I was talking like this, and they wanted me to.
I would recommend you do this. I mean, now that I hear it, it's vastly superior, isn't it?
Don't
you? I think you've really hit upon. They were right, and you've wasted all this time.
But I started with a voice anyway. So we're with you meeting, not meeting, but going on the set of Being There, because I love Being There stories.
When I was in film school.
Where did you go to film school?
I went to film school at Loyola. I was accepted into USC. I was an electronics engineer, and I did this great project thing where you I was lucky. I was in a school where you did work study, so I was in school for 6 months, and I worked for 6 months. So in the 4 years of that program, I worked as an electronics engineer a lot for the FAA at a place called the National Aeronautics Federal Experimental Center. They would send me up in these old World War II tail draggers to fly through thunderstorms to find out why planes crashed in thunderstorms.
What?
And I would take wind shear measurements. Yeah. Because it's like, you know, put the kid in the
of
plane.
Course.
Yeah, it was, you know.
Expendable
it
child.
Was. And I loved it. I loved it because you would go up. It was out over Atlantic City. You would go up in over the ocean into these clouds, and you would fall 3,000, 5,000 feet. So it was the greatest roller coaster you ever experienced. Now I would not be able to do it. Now I'm a little afraid to get in my car. Like that. In those days, it was fine. In those days, it was an exciting thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I wanted to get out of there. So I applied to USC and Loyola. I had this great book that showed you all the equipment in all the cinema schools in the United States. And I saw that Loyola had the same equipment as USC. Now, I was accepted into Loyola and USC, but USC was a six-month waiting list to get into their big-time film program. So I figured I'll go to Loyola and I'll transfer over. But I never would have done well at USC because it was like a little movie studio. You could write a script in their program and not get to direct it. They will give it to someone else to direct. You get fired in school. It's like it's you know, it's just to get you ready for the real thing. Loyola just had the equipment, which is really all I wanted, and a lot of really lovely teachers who just encouraged you, and you could just go out and do these things, make your own movies. So you would hire for free the actors in and around time. And there was a lovely guy named Perrin Page, who was in a few of my projects. Called me one day, says, "I'm an extra on Being There. I know how much you love Peter Sellers." Am I saying that name right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And you know, obviously Clouseau is a huge, huge thing for me. So we're shooting in Pasadena, and I also, Hal Ashby is a god and everything. He said, you know, come on down. I said, really, I can come watch the filming? Absolutely. Perry is a very positive guy. So I figure, all right, you know, I know what crews look like. I've kind of seen them before. So I dress in all denim. Figure I'll really, really blend in. I get there. It's a mansion in Pasadena, and everyone is dressed completely in tuxedo. So I am sticking out worse than if I had a horn, it would have been a worse thing. And so I walk on, and Perry brings me onto the set. He goes, "Here's where they're shooting." And there's nobody there. There's really just Hal and a tiny little camera crew and Shirley MacLaine, who I later got to know very well, and Peter. And they're doing the scene. And I'm saying, "Are you sure I can be here?" And Perry's like, "Absolutely. It's a lovely set. It's a lovely, lovely set." So I sit down, and like Hal Ashby is like, he has his back like pretty much three quarters to me, and then Peter's beyond him. And I'm sitting there, and I got to watch like, you know, like 10 takes, and it was a dream. I learned everything about directing in that one day. Not really, but I learned a lot. It was great, and watch my idol. And I figured, well, I guess this is okay. And then during a take, literally during a take, Peter Sellers acting his heart out brilliantly, Hal Ashby just happens to like look over his shoulder, and he sees me, and I figure, you know, I've been here for a long time, and so I kind of, you know, And Hal Ashby just freezes, and he looks at me like this. And he never looks back at Peter. He lets the entire take go.
Glaring.
Think, yeah, glaring. You know, and he, you know how red he was. He had red eyes to begin with and the white hair. Crazy white hair. So it was like the god of directing show business just putting his wrath at me. And I figured he's going to kill me. And he's going to make sure I'm never in show business. I also felt that this was the end of everything.
Yeah.
And it finally says, cut, and he just turns away. And I'm like, oh. And very nicely, a first AD then comes up to me a few moments later and says, there really can't be anybody else in here. So I left. But that stare was like, and it was so frightening because, like I said, I'm a very shy person. And I, you know, show business was intimidating. And it was like, get out of show business. It's like, that's what was so horrible. So it was the exact opposite of your welcome and let me do Inspector Clouseau for you and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, it was like, get out of here.
I've taken that with, are you Mel's granddaughter? You know, that's why I try to affect that when I'm on the set. Like, because that is the hardest thing to, you know, when I was going to school at the neighborhood playhouse, they'd always be shooting movies on the set, right. You know, on the streets and stuff. And you'd always try to, you know, be a looky-loo and watch. And,
right. And I mean, you were around for Goodfellas. And, you know, that's the other great thing about your book. You have a perspective on that no one else has ever talked about.
No.
Which is just great.
Which I thought was crazy. People have suggested, which I could, like in literally an entire book on Goodfellas, because I was there almost every day.
There should be. And amazingly enough, I looked it up when you were talking about it. There are no good books on the making of Goodfellas.
No, I know.
There aren't. And, you know, Marty's, you know, as a filmmaker, you spend all this money to go to film school, and you know, I speak at film schools all the time. You know,
I'd
and
love
I
to.
Lecture. Yeah, please come. You'll learn. But anyway, but yeah, so I speak at USC and UCLA and everything. Mm-hmm. Only $50,000 a time, and not really. But you know, you try and give back for a little bit of money. But no, you go and you do that. But when you do something like that and you're talking to all these kids and they're getting excited about something, you want to sort of be honest about what, you know, the experience is. And now they try and they say, can we make a podcast out of this? And I said, if we do that, if we put it on, I can't say everything I'm going to say.
Yes.
So that's,
well, the technical aspects. So let's talk about your films. We're going to get to Heartbreakers, which, you know, I love this film.
That's very, and I know why you like it, because it's a very Bogdanovich. You know, Mike Nichols and Preston Sturges, kind of, you know, that's
my
all
favorite,
like,
kind of.
Exactly. So that was what that was doing in there. That was all.
Because I was saying this before, I want to watch a comedy where I know I'm in good hands. I'm like, what's, and I you know, I like the, you know, the wide shot and the characters. And so I want to get to that because it's crazy Gene Hackman performance. I'm obsessed with Gene Hackman.
He's amazing.
But let's start with Romy and Michelle. And how did that come about?
I will say something.
Do you know I auditioned for this film? Did you know that I lost the part to Jeanine Garofalo? I somehow auditioned for this movie.
That amazes me, because we didn't really audition for Jeanine that I was aware of. You didn't read for me.
No, I would have remembered that.
There's a level of this business.
And I was so mad because my friend Alan Cumming got in the movie, and then I didn't get in the movie. But I used to compete with Jeanine quite a bit.
Did you? Well,
yeah.
You shouldn't feel bad. You shouldn't feel bad about that, because, you know, as everybody knows, and I've experienced it too, there's a whole wank level to show business where you go in and you're doing something when the chances of it ever getting to the right eyes or the right people is not even at that level. Mm-hmm. I knew Jeanine because we worked on Larry Sanders together.
Yes.
The part was literally—it was written and tailored for her. It was with her in mind, so it was always hers to say no to.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to do it right away. So I have no idea.
It's a great script.
I have no idea why anybody was asked to do that. That's, you know, like.
But
I said,
it's interesting that I remember the script.
It is.
I would, you know, I've read.
Well,
a thousand.
I had been offered a whole bunch of scripts to direct, and that was the one that had the voice that was really different and really, you know, interesting. And I wanted to do something with strong women, and kind of a different type of women's story. And so it really appealed to me. And there was very little that I had to do with it. I had to fix it structurally and add some jokes to it and whatever. Mm-hmm. But it was very, very, and it was also, Lisa Kudrow was a friend of mine, and I knew that she was attached to it. It was very, goes way back, because my Julie Brown, who was my fiance, the red-haired one, had actually been in the play Ladies' Room which had Romy and Michelle in it as side characters, and Lisa was one of them. And they were only in the play like 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so it was very interesting that we could do an entire film about that. But I'm here to try and change your mind about something, because you're talking about camera work and comedy, right?
Yes.
There's an enormous amount. There are times when the proscenium type thing that Mel does and what mm-hmm. Bogdanovich does is exactly right. Mm-hmm. But and this is what's happening. And you're absolutely right when you're saying the camera move ruins the comedy mm-hmm. for you. That's because they don't know what they're doing. But if you know how to move the camera for comedy, it can still work. Okay. Raising Arizona proves that, and yeah. The Graduate proves that.
Yes.
And, you know, part of the excitement of The Graduate is brilliantly funny, and yet it is as cinematic as anything is on mm-hmm. Earth. Jim Brooks once said to me, it's really true, that has every type of joke in it that you can possibly create mm-hmm. in The Graduate. I mean, it's kind of, that's amazing. That's, again, Buck
Mike Henry.
Doesn't get better. It doesn't get better than that. And Mike was a big fan of Romy and Michelle. Romy and Michelle has enormous amount of camera movement in it, but not any camera movement that destroys any comedy, because right. you have to know how and when to move the camera. You can have a lot of camera movement, but when there is a joke or something, it has to be in the right position at the right time and leave enough breathing room on either side if you need that.
Right.
But Raising Arizona did some great camera moves that would do mm-hmm. amazing, and even Bogdanovich to an extent, would do amazing dollies into a move, and then someone says the line
yeah.
and it kills you, and it's all part of that reaction. So you see, it's what you're seeing is incompetent camera,
right.
and it's much, much harder to do that. But it doesn't all have to just be that. It can be, you know, if it's done skillfully, you might be able to make it.
Do you know
work.
What my favorite shot in comedy is? Is the wide shot, like if we think classically King of Comedy, the wide shot with the person running through the frame.
Yes.
And then a beat. And then more people running.
It's great.
It's like certain things. And then I'm thinking of... What's Up, Doc? Is the woman who comes out of her room and goes, "Thieves!"
And she falls on
Robbers!
The floor.
And I don't know why that for me, that's like my sweet spot.
It's so funny. And the guys just stand there while she collapses on the floor. No one reacts to her.
What about the wide shot that is just, because I think that you find yourself in life in a wide shot.
You do, yeah.
You're getting out of your car and you're like, what was that? You know, and
yeah.
maybe, I don't know.
No, it's true. So it's a matter of picking and choosing exactly where that is and then where the camera, you don't want to move the camera for no reason. And they said the camera always needs to be in the exact right spot when someone is saying a line or there's a moment. A lot of
yes.
people don't understand that. They think it's random, and it's not. It's
no.
And that's why, you know, you watch and you can study for the rest of your life. The way Mike Nichols stages a scene and the way people move. The way Anne Bancroft comes into the room, into Dustin Hoffman's room in the very beginning of the film.
Right.
And the way she forces herself in and slams the door open and is just invading his space and everything. It's some of the most brilliant. And then obviously when she's seducing him and she lifts the leg up and he shoots through the leg, you know, all that stuff, it
classic.
Does not get better. It's like, you know, you can always see it. Something is like tapping on the ceiling of the very best, and that's what that is.
Well, and then doesn't that go hand in hand, of course, with editing? One of the great, you know, lessons I had was spending a lot of time with Martin Scorsese.
I picture that relationship where you come and say, "Scorsese." Scorsese. Like,
well, because he'd always get mad. He'd say it's Scorsese.
All right, good. Well, I like, you know, it's good.
I
really am grateful that I know him now.
You know, or Scotty Dog. That was his nickname.
Okay. It'll be great if I meet him and say that. He'll be
Scotty
thrilled.
Dog?
Yeah. Hey, Scotty Dog. How you doing, buddy?
Well, because of the big eyebrows. anyway, sidebar. So editing, and so I learned a lot, obviously, about editing, comedy editing, and again, editing and comedy, of course, is crucial. You're sitting there in an editing room, and something you've shot that you know is funny, and it's not cutting together well. And what do you do in that instance?
Usually, the studio fixes. Studio knows what to do. They're the smartest. The sweetest way to ever describe what's going on, because, you know, you have these things where they get involved or where they don't get involved or whatever. Jerry Seinfeld said it best. They're not equipped. That's just the way. That's not their thing. They can run circles around us with finances and, you know, negative pickups and all that's great. But the other stuff is only a handful of people that can really figure that out. That's why they're hiring you.
You know,
it's like I always say, it's like hiring a plumber. The plumber starts with, no. I tell him, move that pipe and connect it to that pipe. That right. doesn't work. So I'm paying you. So I get to tell you exactly what. And then you flip a light switch and your room fills up with shit. That's kind of what making a movie or a TV show with a lot of interference with people that aren't trained can create. And right. then they get mad that why did that happen? It's like, well, you know, maybe.
Well, that's always a challenge. I want to get back to the editing thing.
Oh, yeah. So you have to, you know, and this comes with time. And, you know, and I learned Bogdanovich shot all of Paper Moon. He edited the whole thing in the camera because yes. he didn't want to let the studio have a choice. So he just he would stop it when he knew he was going to go into a close up and only get the close up.
Yeah.
So the studio go, oh, we should be wise. No, no, we don't have that. So you edit a lot in your head. It's good to know, and you get a feel when you're on the set if you haven't worked it out already and whatever or things change. You go, okay, we need to be here for this and we need right. to work this out. But it's a good idea to be editing in your head mm-hmm. for certain things. If it's just a conversation and there's going to be subtle things happening back and forth, then just cover it. If there's movement and stuff, you really kind of have to know. And, you know, I would think, oh, maybe it's somewhat random. But then you watch the way Mike does it or you watch the way Peter did it and those and Marty, obviously. And you go, no. These guys, you got to really learn that and study that. And by watching those movies again and again, just with that head, you kind of get an idea about what's happening. And then it starts to happen naturally, you know, the more you do it. That's the sad thing is that movies are so expensive and you can't do it as much as you'd hoped. I always get so jealous. They had their own problems, but of the old movie system where you're doing 10 a year and doing every single style, that was always my goal. Yeah. Not just do all just comedy or one type of comedy, but to do different kinds. That's why Heartbreakers and Romeo and Michelle are two different things. You know, that was on purpose.
Completely.
Yeah.
Now, were you a fan? Am I correct in saying that Heartbreakers is a kind of Preston Sturges?
Oh, totally. Totally. That was a goal. You know, that movie was originally Ang Lee directing. And so
he's
this,
funny.
He's hilarious. Hilarious. Said, well, he did Sense and Sensibility, right? Hilarious. Lots of funny stuff in that, right? Isn't it? It's really good.
Yeah.
So, but Ang, yeah, and this was kind of after that. So Ang was directing this, and they said, we need a better director than Ang Lee. Who's there a better director than Ang Lee? Dave Merkin. That's what everybody, I'm pretty sure, pretty much people say that once a day. And it was Angelica Houston and Alicia Silverstone. And I saw it. In those days, you could kind of see, they would print things when they were more in development. They don't do that as much anymore because there's less in development in a way. But and I looked and I saw what that movie was. And I said, gee, I wish I could do that movie. That's a really great movie. And then about a year later, the phone rang and said, we'd like you to do this film. And it was a different cast at that point. It was really Cher that brought me onto that movie. It was going to be Cher and Jennifer Aniston, who was a friend of mine because she was in The Edge.
Yes.
And, you know, I adored her and have a great time with her. And so I sort of developed it with Jennifer and Cher in mind. And that went so far, only so far. Mm-hmm. And then it became Sigourney and, you know, and Gene Hackman and everything in there, which is just, it's typical. There was a whole regime change at MGM that changed that thing. But yeah, that was my opportunity to do what I had loved about Bogdanovich and Sturges, and to an extent Mel Brooks and you know, Woody and all that. But the main thing, because it was that area and that kind of con thing, was, you know, very much the Paper Moon kind of feel and stuff like that. So
Palm Beach Story,
exactly.
It's got that.
Yeah.
And then now Gene Hackman, doesn't he notorious? You know, he's the one person I would love to. He's my, when people always say, "Who do you want to interview?" I would, because my grandfather always talks about him being the favorite actor he ever worked with.
He's one of the most amazing people on earth, and he was, again, a lucky accident. I wrote that part, and this is going to crack you up about who Gene Hackman is interchangeable with in that particular film. I wrote that part specifically for John Cleese. And I sent, because John Cleese is a coughing, angry, tobacco rich person, would have been great.
Yeah.
And John loved it. And he said it was the best thing ever written for him in America. He was so excited to do it. And then, again, the brilliant studio being, John Cleese works in a particular way. He doesn't want any trouble. Doesn't want any trouble because, you know, showbiz is just full of all this bullshit. You know? So he just has a price. Right. And you just, if you offer him anything beyond his price, you'll never hear from him again. So I won't give the price, you know, because it'll upset people. But it's $250 a day. but they said, you know what? We're gonna offer him, you know, almost all his money, but we're gonna then defer another amount, couple of $100,000 deferred. And I said, if you say defer to John, you will never hear from him again. We know what we're doing. Say, don't tell him that. And before I was able to stop him, they told him that he was gone. So now they're panicked. They're going, he's gone. I said, you know, it's kind of like we told you he was gone. So I then start contacting John Cleese and say, look, you know, I'm so sorry that happened. I finally got caught. He says, you know, I just work for a certain amount of money a year. I already took another job. So it's going to interfere. So I'll say, and you know what this is, I say, I'll do a drop and a pickup on you. In other words, you come, do the movie, then you leave, do your other thing, come back, and we'll do the rest. He goes, that's a lot of running around. I can't do it. You know, I'm not going to do that. So now we're about to start production. There's no time for me to rewrite the script. I told him, I said, the only other person that has these cadences and has this kind of thing is Gene Hackman. And Gene Hackman, why did I know he was great in comedy? That all started with Young Frankenstein. That one little scene.
That one scene.
That one scene told you everything you need to know that he is a genius in comedy. And Gene is hilarious. He's hilarious and Unforgiven. He's, you know, and that's, again, mixing darkness with comedy makes everything that much more scary, you know. And you have crazy people who are also hilarious. It's like Joe Pesci and, you know, in Goodfellas. It's more terrifying in that way. So offered the role to Gene, and he loved it. He got, you know, he got excited. He was twice as expensive.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, and that's,
knew,
you know, so that's what
I
always happens.
That was coming. Yeah.
That's what. Now this will upset John Cleese. He's getting twice what I... but anyway, and then the studio then comes to me and goes, well, you got to find the extra money. And I go, I didn't make this mistake. You made this mistake. And that became a fight through the entire film, this extra money, where it was going to come from or not going to come from. And, you know, so you can't win. Even if they go, we made the mistake, but you have to pay for it. You do have to pay for it. You know. So, but anyway, Gene was great. But I then heard a story. He can be, if he's not happy, he can be one of the scariest guys in the world.
So every movie, you know, when you're in a movie, like I'm shooting a movie in Chicago, and the Teamster who drives you to work, and usually in a big van, they want to do is tell you a story. And they talk about two people, Gene Hackman and Tommy Lee Jones.
Oh, there you go. That's a great
those
combination.
Those are the two people that apparently are the most unpleasant people ever to drive in a film. So
I
there
think
you
it
have
was,
it. I've
I
never
think,
met either of them.
I think it was David Duchovny who told me just the scariest story. And Gene was like he became a Marine when he was 16 years old. He is so tough and so strong. And, you know, he was a roommate with Dustin Hoffman.
Yes. And we'll get the Pasadena.
At the Pasadena Playhouse and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And when Dustin was living with him, Gene would say to him, this was literally like living with Gene Hackman. He'd say, I'm going to go out and get in a fight. And that's what Gene would do every night. He would go out and get in a fight. So, you know, he's a tough guy. And obviously, we're similar. We're similar. We're very macho.
Yes.
Why does that always get a reaction like that? But anyway, I heard these other nightmare stories the day before I was really going to get together with them. Actually, so the phone rang one day, like not long after I made the deal with them. And it's Gene. He says, hey, how you doing? You got any ideas? I don't have any ideas. that was his. I said, we're going to have a great time. Don't worry about anything. You know, it's going to be a blast when you come here. So the secret of Gene Hackman is he just does not suffer fools. And so as long as you give him something that's intelligent and that you're moving quickly, you know, in your rehearsal process and that you're open. I worked, you know, part of working with Bob Newhart is he had been around forever, you know, even back then. He had already done one show. Now we were doing the second show. It works his ass off. But once it gets to be 10 o'clock when we're shooting live in front of an audience, he starts looking at me, you know, if I was directing it or even if I was just the show running. And he, you know, go, I want to go home now. We don't need to go till 2 in the morning. I've been very successful not doing this. And he was absolutely right. It's the same thing with anybody. You know, I worked with Bob Elliott on Get a Life, Chris's dad. And he was brilliant and great, but you couldn't work him late into the night. He was in his 70s. He didn't want to live in it. You know, by the time you get to that, you realize it's stupid to be in a soundstage, and there's better life out there than that, you know. So it was the same thing with Gene. So Gene, the trick with him And the trick to keeping him sighted is I would write him new things as we kept going, because he was such a great actor that he could just nail whatever you gave him right away. So if we're going to do another take, it better be a good reason for it. So let's try something else. And he loved learning new stuff, and he had a great time, and he laughed. And I had just a perfect dream time with Gene Hackman, because, again, to me, it's a matter of creating an atmosphere for an actors who I love, where they can do their best work. And it's unfortunate if an actor needs to have a horrible atmosphere to do best work. The best combination.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm very good in the interviews and sussing out whether we're going to work together. We always talk about how we work, how many takes I like to do, how many takes they like to do, how they like to do. Because I'm trying to create a thing where all we're doing is having a good time. Because if you're not having a good time 17 hours a day, it becomes the worst job in the world.
Yes.
And that's ridiculous, you know?
Now, was he copying W.C. Fields?
I think there's a certain amount that he did in that first shot that was kind of like WC, where he falls down and everything. He's got the crane, he's chasing it. Just a little bit of, I felt that there was a little bit of, but he wouldn't say it. That's a good way to get him mad, right? What you say, hey, are you doing
Are you doing WC Fields?
Do you have no ideas of your own? Is that why? Huh? You're not creative, right?
She
you're just
kind of, said it.
Yeah,
not
I know.
Us.
You see what I mean? That's the difference. Hey, I love the fact that you're ripping off the other guy.
Well, you could always do the switcheroo, which is like, you'd say, were you doing that? And you get mad. And they were like, no, that's I said to you. I said, Bob, that's crazy. He is not doing WCP. You got to. Have you ever had a joke? This is Hollywood. So I made the mistake. I used to hang out at the table, you know, with Paul Mazursky. And
right, at the Farmer's Market
George
and stuff.
Siegel,
is that right?
Yes, yeah. Jeff Garlin and everything.
I was told not to show up there many times.
Okay.
But, you know, you get into that kind of borscht belt, like, you know, razzing each other.
Right.
And I went to this, like, highfalutin party and made a joke and got in trouble with a director. He got like really,
there is a certain amount of thin skin and you know, I can tell, you know, I'll tell this because, you know, Gary has passed and I'm sure he wouldn't mind. Gary had a tendency to get in trouble by saying things. And in fact, Shanling had a character that he would do. It was like a Don Rickles character, which was kind of an insult character that he would do at parties. And he was making people laugh, and there was a lot of laughter around them at this particular party. And Kevin Costner walks up to him and says, hey, what's going on? This sounds like a lot of fun. Gary says, I do this kind of Don Rickles character that, you know, everybody loves, and, you know, it's just kind of funny. He said, oh, really? And I'm not kidding. And I've done some work with Kevin Costner, and he was adorable. I love him and everything, but it's just this moment. And Kevin Costner literally said, oh, really? Well, what would this character say to somebody like me? That's literally what he said. So he's asking for it. And this was right after this particular movie, Waterworld.
Yes.
And Gary's Don Rickles character goes, don't worry, your next movie will be on land. And Kevin Costner got so mad. He goes, you know, it's the people like you that depend on people like me not to punch them in the face. He walked away. So there you go. But that was a moment at a party, and they then, you know, it was all fine.
But he laughed. Oh, my God. I went home. I was like, I had that, I'll never be invited to another party, you know.
No, I've done that. You know, the other thing is with my dark humor, I'll, like, make up something about, you know, somebody like ODing on drugs or blowing their brains out, and someone was like, well, that actually happened. You know, because it is Hollywood where people have very intense stories. So when I'm making up these things that I think are so exaggerated, you'll sometimes run into, and I've probably even picked up psychically is where I got the joke somehow, and I'm throwing it back as some sort of horrible thing, and, you know, as a joke, and it's not. So,
well,
it's
true. They said they're always, you know, there's that kind of, you know, people make jokes about this is actually true now in the Gavin DeBecker book, which I love this book.
Yes, yeah, Gavin's a great guy. Another lovely guy and very, very close with Gary Shanling, too.
But The Gift of Fear.
Yes.
Which is a really interesting book, but it talks about people using humor as a precursor to knowing something terrible is going to happen. Like somebody gets a letter and they go, well, I'll be in my office because when it explodes, I don't want to be here. And 2 minutes later, it would explode. So sometimes, humor is a kind of a psychic.
Sometimes, and even writing a script is a psychic. I can't tell you how many scripts I've written where something happens and then it happens. And, you know, it's happened on The
Why
Simpsons.
Why is that? Too. Me too.
Because, you know, we're picking things up you know, out of the air. You know, it's like it really is like leaked energy from other places, I think, a lot.
So I have a technical question for you, which is when you're writing, because what I found, I only wrote I had two experiences writing a pilot for a network, and I hated it. I didn't have the stomach for it. So when I got, and one of my downfalls was they'd want you to rewrite a joke. And then it was something that was like, I was so down, be like, I know that nothing is going to be funnier than this joke, but yet you'd have to write another joke, and they reject that. And then around the time you're at the fifth, you're like, I have no other joke in me.
Yes.
So give people advice for people like me to not give up. And and what do you do when you're in that situation?
It's, you know, and a lot of people will not admit this and say what it is. And it is kind of, it's physical violence against the network people is the only thing that really gets the kind of respect that you need. Yeah. A chair to the back.
Down.
Yeah. It's a great, you have to say no. And it is not easy. And it has gotten harder because they've become more of a corporate entity.
You have 30 people commenting on a 20-minute script.
Here's my incredible piece of luck, and this is why The Simpsons has been on for 30 years and all, and I've been so fortunate. You know, Three's Company was its own thing. It was completely left alone by the network because Mickey and Bernie are Emmy-laden people from All in the Family. Mm-hmm. And then Three's Company also had 40 million people a week watching it. It was the number one or number two show, so who's going to tell you anything? Then took over the Newhart show. So it was actually good that I didn't get on Cheers, because when I left, if I had gotten on Cheers, I would have just been a writer under Glenn and Les, who were brilliant. Mm-hmm. But I never would have risen to showrunner as quickly as I did. My very next job, I luckily, through a series of murders and blackmail, was able to rise to showrunner very quickly. And MTM, which, you know, was started by Grant Tinker, was one of the most brilliant men on television. He's the one responsible for Cheers, and he's the one responsible for... He didn't care that they were the lowest rated shows. He says, we're going to be good first, and then the people will come, and it will take a year. Mm-hmm. Dick Van Dyke Show was canceled after its first year. MASH was basically canceled. They all started to be successful in their summer reruns, things that don't exist anymore.
Right.
So it takes time. When you're writing in a new way, in a cool way, it takes time for the audience to catch up. They're not with you right away.
Right.
You have to train the audience. You literally, and to say, okay, you're three and out, six and out, you know, that you can't do as much, you can't experiment. Though TV is fantastic right now because of all the outlets. Network TV is not, but the other outlets can be.
Right.
But anyway, so you have MTM. When I took over the show, they said to me, this was the philosophy of MTM, this is where Jim Brooks came from. It was a writer company, kind of created by writers, run by writers. Because Grant Tinker would say this, most brilliant man, he says, I hire the right people. And he says, and I don't get out of the way, I jump out of the way.
Wow.
And that's what you do. You hire your plumber who's been trained in what he's doing and let him do what he's trained to do. And the people from the network, he said to me, the guy running MTM, Arthur Price at that time, who was Mary's manager too, he said, if you have a disagreement with the network, we back you. If we agree with the network against what you're doing, we back you. Mm-hmm. That's what it was. So you just had complete control. The terrible thing that happened to a young guy on his first job. And the very first show that I had complete control over, and I got to write my script exactly the way I wanted, I got an Emmy nomination. So that was all a very, very bad reinforcement, you know. You go, oh, this works to do this, and so you protect that. So coming out of the MTM situation, then you'd have the liaisons from CBS, and these are the same liaisons from the Mary Tyler Moore Show. They were probably in their 60s by now, or they seemed ancient to me, but super. This is what they do. They come to a run-through, and they'd watch the run-through, and they'd look at me, and they go, you know what to do, and then they would leave. That was their note.
Wow.
You know, because that was the truth, and that's how you got, and we were the top show on CBS for years and years and years. So I was able to take from that situation contractual freedoms that have followed me throughout my career. And that's the thing. But still, when I did Get a Life, which, you know, it was very surreal. And it was, Get a Life was designed to show you that most of the sitcoms on TV were bullshit. It was designed to make you really dislike or realize that these things were lies and to make fun of them.
Right.
That's not a good thing for a network. They don't like that. I mean, you know, your business model, my thing is trying to destroy that business model. Is that okay? You want to put that on? So, and we kind of snuck that show on under the radar in a way they didn't completely understand. And then I really made it surreal once we got on the air. He was a psychotic. He literally he was losing his grip on reality. No TV character had ever done that, particularly on network television. So we had fight after fight after fight. And they would shut me down. They would read the script on Monday, and they'd say, you can't do this script. And I'd say, well, you approve the story. But they could never imagine how subversive and weird the story was going to be until they saw it on paper.
Right.
And then they would get super upset. I said, you know, you approved it. And they said, but it's not. And I said, there's no time to change it and still make it good. Because you can't write a whole script in a week when you're in production and I'm directing the show too. It's just that's what makes things bad. You have to trust yourself and keep making what you've worked on for months better and better and better. That's the way good things I've studied where good things come from. That's where they come from. That's the method. And so they would shut me down, and then I would send them a bill for $300,000 for the set because that's how much it cost at that point, and they had technically approved it at that point. So and then they would capitulate after like a day or two, and then I would lose all the rehearsal time. And we'd have to, put the show up and on its feet in 2 days less. But, and it was exhausting. And it's always exhausting. And it's always – I was lucky on both my films. They did not bother me about the script on either movie. They let me do exactly what I wanted to do. And I think in the editing room later in the music, there's fights on Romy and Michelle.
Right.
There were some fights on huge fights on Romy and Michelle about the music.
Mm-hmm.
They're odd characters. So the music had to be a little off, a little bit edgy. And the music was testing through the roof. It was testing at 92, 94%. Every single person writing on their card, where can I buy the soundtrack, right? And the studio comes to me and goes, we need to change the music.
Oh, no!
And I'm saying, it's the highest. And said, but we can get the whole film higher if we change the music. That's their plan. And, I can't. And I put a couple of things in for them, and then it wasn't enough. And so it just became this huge fight, and it went on and on. Finally, they let me have my way. There's maybe like two things that aren't my first choice, but they're my second choice at least. They didn't ruin everything. And then we sold not one best-selling soundtrack, but two off the movie. So it was just as the cards were telling us. But yeah, it's crazy. It makes no sense. And you just have to be ready for that. And there becomes a point in your career where you're going, I had about enough of this.
Yeah. But the difference is that in some people, like I worked with the late Chris Thompson, it does break the person where they can't.
It can.
And one of the things I admire about you is you seem to have the ability to negotiate with executives in ways that I certainly didn't or other people can't.
I use my sexuality. And,
because
everyone in a room,
men
and women alike, are attracted to me. So you just work it, And so I'm able to just kind of, you guys feel it, right? Yeah. There's enormous tension.
Well, yes. I always watch people that have an ability to talk to executives, and I wish I had that ability.
Believe me. I hear what you're saying. Believe me, I've never been good at that. I've been quite the opposite of that, which is, I've said and get a life and multiple times. And by the way, I love these guys. I don't blame them. As Jerry Seinfeld said, they're not equipped. It's like yelling at someone who's just not, you don't know how to be a plumber because you've never been trained to be a plumber. It's not their fault.
You know,
their fault is that it's their job to say something. And that's the way it goes. But I said, I don't know why I would listen to what you were saying because what you said, I said that. I said, because what you said last time didn't make it. We had this Spewy episode. I don't know, you guys don't know. It was an alien that comes down.
Is this on Get a Life?
On Get a Life.
Yeah.
I was furious about, I loved E.T. the first time I saw it.
Yeah.
Then I was with my girlfriend and I got the $100 laser disc to watch E.T. at home a couple of years later or whatever. And we watched it. It was horrible. By then, everything that Steven had done in that movie had become a cliche. And it was too... And there had been so many movies now that all aliens were huggable that it seemed like a very trite and horrible experience. So it was this horrible experience. So because of that, I had an alien come down and I got these guys that were big fans of Get a Life to build me a $70,000 alien with a little guy in the suit with all animatronics and everything. Arturo was the guy in the suit for like $7,000.
Mm-hmm.
And the alien is the most vile, horrible thing. He's puking in Chris's face. He's defecating out of his elbows, and his head. One of the first images I have, his head going 360 degrees, is just puking all over this beautiful new living room of Chris's neighbor. And Chris, because he had seen ET and only he's teaching us about love. Can't you tell? You know, he just had no idea that this was a horrible, vile alien. And so, what happens is Brian Doyle Murray eventually gets sick of the alien puking on him so many times, and he beats him to death with a rake. And so Chris comes home and he goes, "Where's Spewitt?" He goes, "We're actually eating him, you know, because he cooked him and everything." And Chris goes, "That's horrible, but he does actually taste pretty good." So they keep eating Spewitt, and then they both meet up at the refrigerator late at night. And "Are you here for the same reason I am?" He goes, "Yeah, if he's as good cold." Oh, and they open up the refrigerator, and Spewy has regenerated from his own leftovers. And he comes out of the refrigerator angry, and he gets taken back up into space because they finally have come. His friends have come and take him home. So they approved the script. They let me shoot it. When they saw it, and they could not picture all the puking and the shit, because when he shits out of his arms, Chris runs over. It was actually custard. He runs over with a cup, and then he drinks it. And he goes, "Don't drink what's coming out of that thing," Brian Doyle Murray says. He goes, "Try nectar of the gods." This is, and he's got it all over his face. So they were appalled. They said, "The first episode we can't ever air."
Wow.
This is what the executives said, the people on the show. Luckily, it then got sent up to Peter Chernin running the network.
Yes.
He said it was the funniest thing he ever saw. So the next time they tried to give me notes, I said, "You guys can't agree with yourself.
Yeah.
Why are we discussing this?" So not a good thing to say. None of that is intelligent. If you want to be a producer, that's not the way to talk to them. I don't really.
Except that it's clearly worked for you.
I've been lucky. I've been incredibly, incredibly lucky.
God, I hate to. We have so much. Yeah, will you come back and talk?
I will. Let's set a date. You have your phone?
Okay, I do. Okay. We did that joke on Welcome to Sweden. Actually,
did that? Yeah, I cracked me up to see you in Welcome to Sweden because I do the IKEA show.
Yes.
And then the funny thing is, on the next show I'm seeing about Sweden, you're in that too. That was the funniest thing.
Well, my life is like yours. It's like they were like, when you think of Sweden, you think of Ileana Douglas.
That's really.
That's right.
Because of IKEA, but. Anyway, Dave, thank you so much. And it's interesting, as you were talking about Get a Life, it's always the shows that are the oddballs that it almost seems like your favorite child in a way. It's like you could do a reboot.
We probably wouldn't do that. I like to kind of leave, because they've tried to do, you know, I've fought against Romy and Michelle coming back.
Yeah.
Because it's hard. It's hard to do that. And it's better to come up with new things.
Romy and Michelle.
But it's, there's a lot of affection for that. And exactly. Romy and Michelle
on
now
a cruise.
Would be, so yeah, it would be great.
On a cruise ship. Well, you know, I do the TCM cruise.
Often do you do that, by the way?
Well, once a year. Although
once a year,
this year is the last year.
Oh, okay.
It's so sad. But, you know, Jerry Lewis.
I know, 90, that's amazing.
91.
Wow.
Leslie Caron, 86. So I'm like a youngin'.
Sure.
But I love, you know, my favorite pictures that I take is of all the scooters that are outside the theater. There's like hundreds.
That's hilarious.
Scooters.
Brilliant.
Jerry Lewis's book, The Ultimate Filmmaker. Is that what it is? The Ultimate. Did you ever see that?
The Total Filmmaker.
There with the crane. That was like porn for me when I was trying to learn
book,
to be a
writer. It's a great book. Hard to get. I have an inscribed copy.
There you go.
Of course she does.
That's great. Yeah, it's about a $300, $400 book. And the greatest thing is he says, "I've gotten on my hands and knees on a moviola, on a flatbed, and licked emulsion to try and get more of myself into the film." That is The Total Filmmaker.
I could see Jerry doing that.
Oh, he's great. He's the best.
Going on. Anyway, Dave Merkin, thank you so much.
You,
we didn't even get to talk about Tulane Blacktop.
There you go. James Taylor. But see the James Taylor videos that I've directed? They're around.
Yes.
And also the guitar lessons that I do with James. The greatest guitar lessons ever, where he'll teach you how to play, and he's the most amazing acoustic guitar player in the world.
We're going to have you come
better
back.
Better than Esteban?
He is better than Esteban.
Okay, wow. It's a little bit better.
You are Dave Merkin on Twitter, from what I understand.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right, yes.
M-I-R-K-I-N. The funniest man, and if you're ever at a cocktail party,
just come
gravitate
right up to me.
You won't be able to avoid it, because he's clearly the man with the charisma.
There you go.
The best. Dave Merkin. Thank you. As we say, everyone's life is a movie with a beginning and a middle and an end. And this is sadly the end of our very funny show. But you will come back, Dave.
We will make you come back.
Yes. Thank you, Dave Merkin.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.
Producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network. We would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com.
I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.